We are in part two of our series, God and the Skeptics. Part two deals with the seven reasons for faith. And the second one that we're dealing with today is the innate knowledge of God, that there is within all men an innate knowledge of God, innate within their heart. Romans 1:19 explains that because that which may be known of God is manifest, is made open in them, for God has showed it unto them. God showed it unto them. The situation with our sin condition is one of the mind, one of the soul. The soul is the heart, the mind and the will and the emotions. So the way we think, what we choose, what we want, and how we feel about things, all of this has been tainted by sin. And the apostle frequently mentions that when we were dead in trespasses and sins, then it was a darkness that would keep us from seeing the light. Well, God has been working to not undo that, because that only happens at salvation, but to cancel out the eliminating thing, because he says so that they can't see the glory of God and be saved. So God is actually working. John chapter 1, talking about Jesus Christ being the true light of the world, that he is the light that lighteth every man that cometh into the world. Now, I frankly don't understand exactly what that means, but light being the opposite of darkness, darkness being ignorance, light is something that helps us to see things as they really are. So God is showing mankind, he is making it open inside them, the things that can be known of God. Now, some actually call this reason for faith the argument from morality, or some even the anthropological argument, anthropos being the Greek word for mankind, not male or female, but mankind. And so what makes mankind mankind is some of these very things. Now, we want to look at what are we dealing with here? Well, there's two claims. First of all, the Bible claims that there is a God outside of time and space who created the universe of time and space. So he didn't create himself. He didn't create that. He was outside of time and space, created the entire universe operating through time and created space. It claims, the Bible claims, that God made everything very good, but something happened that changed all that. The something is that the first humans sinned and a curse came over the universe. It's fascinating to me just to think of this, that at the time of sin, mankind fell from his life connection to God. That was actually severed, as though a plant being plucked from the vine. And so he began to wither. Mankind began to wither and die. God said to him, in the day you eat thereof, you shall surely die. The Hebrew says it literally, in dying you will die. And so there's a whole process of dying going on. He didn't drop over dead the day he sinned, but he began to die. So what happened there was that death and death-causing conditions spread over all the world. We find that as a result of sin, such things as thorns and thistles began to grow, which led to the invention of shoes, soles on your feet. And it was one of those amazing things where there was a catastrophic decrease in the universe because of sin. So decay, which is the relentless path to death, became the law of the universe. if you study science and learn the first and second laws of thermodynamics. There are only a few laws in science, and a law is a law because it's a principle that there has never been any known exception for it. Very different, for instance, from the theory of evolution, the laws of thermodynamics. And the second law of thermodynamics is that with every transfer of energy from one thing to another, there is a loss of energy, irretrievable, that is just loss in space, as it were. And so you find that things become less and less organized. You leave things to themselves, and they fall apart. One pastor visited his member, and he pointed out, he says, God and you have a really great garden there. And the man was a little miffed by that, and he said, ha, you should have seen it when God was doing it all by himself. Well, the thing is that God made it to where it'll grow. That's the big thing. But sin has caused it to be full of weeds and terrible things. So now God went to extraordinary lengths to rescue man from the cursed world because he had created man for the purpose of loving fellowship with him. So God actually reaches out. He touches us with conscience. He touches us with the knowledge of God. He touches us by putting his law, his sense of what is right and wrong, putting it within us. We have that within us. We don't choose to do that. We don't learn to do that. It's true of every man everywhere in all of time and in every place. So, for instance, God has proclaimed that murder is wrong because of this special purpose of man's creation. We are created in God's image. And he says that's why murder is wrong. And this is what the Bible claims. So that's claim number one. Then we find secular humanism, with its evolutionary philosophy, claims that animals and man evolved from one-celled creatures. That life began in a one-celled creature, and then all life evolved from that. It claims, then, that man is just another kind of animal. Like the tiger is different from the jellyfish, man, it says, is no better than other animals, even though he's smarter. This seems to be, in their idea, the chief difference, just smarter. Some of the man animals have developed rules based on their culture, and others have developed very different rules based on their very different culture. These differences should be respected and appreciated, but that's all that religion is. That's all that morality is. And this is what secularism claims. All right. Our job this morning is to look at the problem of this, because it's easy to say any of these things. You know, you can make up anything. And the problem is this, that conscience, that sense of right and wrong, is the organ of moral obligation, what you ought to do and what you ought not to do. And it's found in all men everywhere. Now, perhaps the most startling example of this I read was Timothy Keller, who wrote the book that I adapted this study from. Timothy Keller, in his 20 years of ministry in very liberal New York City. People told him he couldn't start a church there. It would just be rejected. It would be mocked. But he actually built a very, very vibrant work there. He found that the young adults he met had a strong sense of right and wrong. They have a moral outrage over many things happening in the world. And these are not people of his church members. These are not Christians. These are people who are visiting unsaved secular people of the city. And so within the heart of liberalism, there was this attitude that certain things are right and certain things are wrong, and those people are evil because they have chosen the wrong thing. Very strong opinions. Now, this condition of their having such moral outrage, that's not the claim of the Bible, nor is it the claim of secularism. But it is simply the way of life on earth. We're not arguing for a philosophy here. We're just explaining the way things are. So our question to the skeptics, to the doubters, is what is moral obligation? What should we understand by this? Well, sociologist Christian Smith said, moral is an orientation, a way of situating yourself toward understandings about what is right and wrong, what is just and unjust, that are not established by our own actual desires or preferences, but instead are believed to exist apart from them. In other words, what you like and what you don't like, that will kind of develop your style, but what you believe is right and wrong, deeply wrong, that's not something you choose. That's something that you feel. And it provides, is believed to exist apart from preferences, providing standards by which our desires and preferences can themselves be judged. All right, the concept then is that we have the sense of moral obligation, and instead of being created by what we want and what we don't want, it actually judges what we want and don't want. We conform our lives to our moral orientation. So, in this situation, as Timothy Keller did in New York, if you ask anyone if he believes that some things are very wrong, he will likely name one or more terrible things. I mean, there's a lot of terrible things going on in the world. I was reading a while back about a ring of child, I think it was child prostitution that was being run in Washington State. It boggles the mind to organize a situation to pander to such perversion. But so somebody that learns about this and you know, just aggravated murder and rape and kidnapping and all of these things, people, especially those who have been touched by any of these things, will have a very strong attitude that those things are just wrong. So you would say then, you consider these wrong even though some people do it. Some people choose to do that, but you say it's wrong. Some dictators, even some cultures, practice these things, but you would say, even though they're okay with it, seemingly, you believe it's wrong. Now that's what we're talking about, you see. This universal characteristic of man is easy to explain from the Bible, but very hard to explain from the secularist point of view. So I want to present to you four possible explanations given, offered by the secularists. So the secularists present four possible explanations. Number one, moral altruism. This is that willingness to limit self for what's right, comes from a gene passed from ancestors who survived in greater numbers. Well, that that would be logical. If everything came by evolution, then what you believe is right and wrong, not just preferences, but right and wrong, must be passed down as well. However, if you know, you can say it, but that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense because the survival of the fittest teaches that survival passes on the genes of success. So the stronger passes on those genes, while the weaker was eaten and couldn't pass them on. The less fit a being is, the more likely he will die, and when he dies, he can't pass on his genetic code. No children for the dead person. Okay? So this leads us to ask, how could altruistic behavior contribute to survival? See, here's the thing. A sense of moral obligation must limit a creature's actions. Limits it to those perceived as good. While the creature with no moral limitations is free to do anything to survive. It would seem like that would put them in a better survival mode. You know, they're not limited by, well, I shouldn't do that. They just do it, see? The one is limited in the violence he's willing to do, while the other is unlimited. So, do you see where that puts the altruistic, the moral gene in the realm of passing it on down? The secularist argues that the moral altruism gene assisted a tribe to survive by the willing sacrifice of individuals. I will give my life for others, would be the idea. And that's logical, it just doesn't explain the problem, because the scientific consensus within secularism is that natural selection does not work on whole populations, but only on individuals. See, it's the individual that passes on his genes. There's nothing, no mass population gene being passed on. So when the moral gene person sacrificed himself for his tribe, his gene is gone, not available for the gene pool. So he's out of it, see? So the one who is willing to sacrifice, the one who had the moral gene, was more likely to die, more likely to give himself. Only those who did not sacrifice themselves lived to pass on their genes. You see how that works? So the whole thing of evolution passing on this moral gene doesn't seem to make sense when you get down to it, that this is limitation. So the others say, well, let's back up a little bit on this. Others argue that the moral gene brought indirect survival benefits to those that he helped. Well, again, that makes sense. He didn't get to pass on the moral gene, but he helped others pass on their genes. But you see, this does not explain why it's happening today. Again, the moral gene would have died out in benefit for the others, the indirect benefit. So it doesn't explain why people today have the motivation to help when no one knows about the past evolution thing where some ancestor sacrificed himself for others. So my conclusion is the evolutionary explanation fails. You can't think evolution and find this self-sacrificing gene being passed on. All right, let's look then at secular explanation number two. The sense of right and wrong, they say, is true only for the culture that evolved it. Now, this is very popular. This is where morality is only part of a cultural relativism. That is, it only makes sense in the culture that you live in. So if you were to find a pre-literate tribe in the jungle, they don't have connection much with any other tribe, but they have their own set of morality. I was reading about a tribe that somebody found that didn't have the people who came to visit had a sense of morality in the sense of covering themselves with clothing. But they said what they had to get used to was in this culture, they wore what would be basically a t-shirt, but nothing from the waist down. And so they would feel very embarrassed if they didn't have a t-shirt. See? But they weren't embarrassed by walking around with the bottom half exposed. This would be the idea of a cultural relativism of moral thought. All right. This argument claims moral obligation did not come from biological evolution, but it came from cultural evolution. You've seen the pictures, the daring swimsuits of the 1800s. They have the striped swimsuits, wrapped them down to the ankles and so on. They've got their swim cap on and their parasol. And you can imagine the guys, whoo, look at that, whoo, you know. And they're just kind of laughably decent by today's standards. Well, morality, they say, is as relative as my belief that my wife and my mother's potato salad is the best. You say, well, you haven't tried mine, or you haven't tried my mother's or something, you know. But so I have an opinion. I have something I kind of grew up with. And so I think that I make the judgment that that's the best. But it's entirely cultural to me. See? So this is what they say all morality is. All right. We can understand that. We can grant them the right to believe it. But they have a problem. The basic problem with this argument is that people cannot live consistently with it. To be the accurate way to think, not only should it be logical within itself, but it should be something that people can actually live with. You see? So if you were to say, I choose to believe that we're all upside down and I should be walking on my hands, you can say this, you see, but very hard to convince others and to actually live that way. Anthropologist Carol Fleur Loban, I thought was, when I read about her, I thought she was the picture of this inconsistency. She decided, because she believed in the concept of cultural relativity, she, however, decided that her view of that was not as important as protecting human rights and especially women's rights. See, her problem was that even though she believed cultural relativity, that equality for women came from Northern Europe in the 18th century. She could see the evidence that that's when the culture developed. But that wasn't going to say, well, then, if you don't believe in women's rights, that's okay, which she should have done because you had a different culture. She felt she had to teach other cultures women's rights. Well, this is an inconsistency, see? If it's a cultural relative, then it's only right or wrong for her in her culture. You go to some other culture, you just have to bite your lip because it's not wrong for them. She says, no, I have to teach women's rights. You can't live this way. So in spite of her philosophy, she knew her beliefs were just better than others. The idea of human rights teaches that every human has inherent dignity and that others must order their lives according to that fact. And those who claim this to be true, they can offer neither proof nor reason to accept it. They're just telling you it's right. It is their moral standard. So, cultural relativism cannot condemn the racial genocide of the Nazis, for instance. We often, you know, if somebody wants to talk about who is the worst person in history, they often go to Hitler, see? Because he was killing millions of Jews, blacks and others, gypsies. He was trying to racially purify humanity. So are you willing to live a life that says, well, Hitler, you know, he did what I wouldn't do, but hey, he just went to the beat of a different drummer, you know? He had his own way of thinking. So who am I to condemn him? We don't do that. I know that there are some people out in Germany now who are actually teaching that it never happened. It was just made up. It was a lie of the Jews. But we have the actual history and the photographs. We know it was there. So to understand that you, to be believing cultural relativity, you have to let everybody choose their own way. And you have to be happy with that. This argument fails because no action can be condemned outside its own culture, and yet mankind actually knows certain things are just wrong. Secular explanation number 3. The concept of human rights, they say, are bestowed by the vote of the majority. Well, this is not a very good one either. Where does this leave the man who wants to speak words contrary to the majority? What if you disagree with the majority? See, the thing is, must we accept the majority's decision to exterminate the minority? No, we're going to say that's wrong. Did not the majority keep slaves? But some said slaves should be set free. Did not the majority restrict the civil rights of blacks in the United States and elsewhere? Did not the majority refuse to allow women to vote? So this explanation puts us back to agreeing with Nazi Germany because at the time, it was the majority vote. This argument fails because whenever a majority claims something is moral or immoral, this particular argument allows the oppression of the minority. We just go by the majority because that's where our morality comes from, this argument says. And we're not going to let the majority rule us in morality. And then the last secular explanation, number 4, just forget explaining and accept the fact there is no morality. This is one of the attitudes. They say, we understand your problems with all these others. We have the same problems. So just forget morality. There's no such thing. There is no such thing as right and wrong. There is just my idea, your idea, and who can get away with it. So this philosophy demands that we accept and live by the standard of nature. So on the playground, somebody tells the bully to stop torturing the younger boy. And so he asks belligerently, says who? So we will call a teacher to make him stop. What are we doing? Finding greater power. We're going up the rank of power. So who has the right to make him stop? Why is it right for him to stop if there's no morality? We accept that greater size and strength, the big teacher in this case, makes the rules. Might makes right. So the more powerful tells everybody else how to live. Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche proclaimed that man had outgrown the need for the concept of God. He said, God is dead. He said, God is dead, and if God is dead, all morality based on love is groundless. Love is a weakness. See? Please, please. Both Nietzsche and Jean-Paul Charles Hamard Sartre argued that there is now no good reason to be kind, to be loving, or to work for peace. Because otherwise, you're just a bully telling other people how to live. When writer Annie Dillard lived for a year by a creek in the mountains of Virginia, she did this expecting to get close to nature and be inspired. Instead, she observed that the principle of violence by the strong against the weak dominates nature. She wrote, "There's not a person in the world that behaves as badly as praying mantises, grabbing each other and eating their heads off." Very seldom see this on the crowds today, you know. She wondered, is nature wrong and only humans are right? Or if nature is right, are humans freaks who rage against the way things really are? So, quickly a conclusion. Are we then to abandon civilization, urge every person to be their own absolute authority, to hide behind a tree or dumpster, and shoot at everybody else? You conquer them by trying to kill them or showing yourself that you have more ammunition and better guns, more explosives, stronger arms, whatever. Are we to conspire to oppress others that we may rule in luxury? And so the answer would be no. But the question would be, why not? Why try to prove yourself good or better when there's no one on the judge's bench? Who will tell me I shouldn't do it? So, from the secularist viewpoint, there is no logical reason. Nature is violence. It is a dog-eat-dog world. Why is it that we humans cannot live like this? This is the real question. Why do we have moral outrage over the evils of the world? The answer, it is because the secular philosophy is wrong. You need to change the premise. The Bible explains it to man. God hath showed it unto them. We saw from Romans. God said, be ye holy, for I am holy. Pastor Miru's text for today. That in verse 15. And so the thing is, you know this to be true in your heart. And I know it's in your heart because God put it there. So, this is one of those things where you can find that if you get into it enough, they can say it, but they can't prove it. They can't actually live like that.